You are listening to Episode 1 of Quarter Share, a trader's tale from the golden age of the Solar Clipper. Written and read by Nathan Lowell. Chapter 1, Neris, 2351, August 13. Call me Ishmael. Yeah, I know, but in this case it's really my name. Ishmael Horatio Huang. My parents had an unfortunate sense of humor, but had they known what I'd wind up doing with my life, they might have picked a different name. Richard Henry Dana, perhaps. Why they picked Ishmael Horatio is a long and not terribly interesting story that begins with my mother was an ancient lit professor, and it ends with my being saddled with these non-sequitur monikers. That story was over 18 Stanyards before the two Neris Company security people showed up at my door with long faces and low voices. Perhaps it was their expression, and perhaps it was that they were looking for me and not Mom, but I knew it wasn't good. I was pretty sure they hadn't come to drag me away. I'd never been a troublemaker, not like some of the other kids in the university enclave. They had come for me, though, to tell me she was dead. It was a sort of an unreal kind of kick-in-the-gut feeling. I knew they were telling me the truth, but I couldn't quite grasp it. Flitter crash, the tall one said. It happens. Not a lot, but enough. You know it can happen, but it always happens to somebody else. It wasn't even her flitter, but Randy's, her boyfriend. He was dead, too, the short one said. They spoke to me gently, and their voices just washed past me. Nothing really seemed to stick. They finally left me alone. 18 Stanyards was old enough to live on your own on Neris. I wasn't taken to Juvie Hall or put into foster care or anything. That night I just kept walking from room to room. I woke up sprawled on the couch next morning, but I didn't even remember sitting down. As bad as that night had been, morning brought something worse. Lawyers. The first time I saw the big coffee urns, I confess, it was a bit intimidating. Cookie introduced me to them very solemnly. "These urns provide the life's blood of the ship," he explained. They were huge, 20-liter urns, bolted to a counter with their own plumbing built in. There were three of them in a row, along with a tap for boiling water for tea. It was like some kind of shrine, resplendent in copper and stainless steel, prominently mounted near the center of the mess deck. He took a heavy mug from the rack, filled it from the valve at the base of the urn, and handed it to me. "What do you think, young Ishmael?" he asked. I looked into the mug. A rainbow sheen floated on the oily sludge in that pristine white china mug. It had a kind of burned, musty smell to it. I had one irreverent notion about burnt offerings before I took a tentative sip. It wasn't as bad as it looked, even black. "Not too bad, Cookie," I said, "but I think it could be better." Cookie smiled, his shocking white teeth flashing against his olive skin. "Excellent," he said, and pointed to the urn at the end of the counter. "Use that urn. Do whatever you must. Make me coffee to cry for," he ordered, and went back to the galley. Pip was aghast. "What in the name of Auntie and Uncle Matter do you think you're doing, Ish?" he exclaimed quietly when Cookie had gone. "Making coffee, of course. That's what Cookie wants." "Yes," he objected, "but you're taking a hell of a risk being critical of the coffee on your first day." I smiled. I may be a greenie on the ship, but coffee I knew, and even making it 20 liters at a time wasn't going to change that. With a kind of odd detachment, I rolled up my sleeves and started in. First thing I did was drag over the step stool, clamber up on the counter, and look into the indicated urn. Sure enough, the inside was coated with a dark and peeling film. A short investigation showed me that the plumbing included hot and cold water, and worse, that the current water temp was lukewarm coming into the pot. Nodding to myself, I clambered down, dragging the filter cone with me. I took it into the main galley and scrubbed it in the deep sink with a stiff brush and a mixture of hot water and white vinegar until it gleamed. Then I returned to the mess deck with a liter of vinegar and poured that into the urn. Cookie was observing out of the corner of his eye, but he pretended not to watch, so I pretended not to notice and continued with my task. Pip was apoplectic. "What are you doing with vinegar?" he spluttered. "Good gods, man, do you know what that'll taste like if you make coffee out of it?" "Yep," I told him calmly. "I'm not going to make coffee out of it." I clambered back up on the counter with the scrub brush. "I'm going to use it to scour the sludge out of this urn." It took quite a while, and I had to ask Cookie for a wrench to get the level indicator tube off the front of the urn and a bottle brush to clean it, but he showed me where to find them without comment. It took me most of a stand, but I finally got the urn cleaned to my satisfaction, inside and out. After final rinse with scalding water, I shut off the hot water valve and cranked the cold water tap open all the way in preparation for making coffee. Pip showed me where to find the coffee and filters. The filters were good quality paper that fit the filter cone perfectly. The coffee, on the other hand, was dreadful. I popped the lid on the airtight that Pip indicated and found some pathetically stale crud in it. I dumped the crud in the waste disposer, dusting out the airtight with a towel. "This is too stale to brew properly. Where are the beans and grinder?" I asked him. Pip just looked at me. "Beans? Grinder?" he asked. "We just put 2 measures of ground coffee in the filter and let her rip," he said. I sighed, went looking for Cookie. I was still chuckling as I got to the berthing area and started changing into civvies. They were getting kind of not worn exactly, tired maybe. My good boots weren't all that good compared to some of the footwear I'd seen in the last 5 months. My jacket was little more than an outdated windbreaker. My pants were what my mother called good solid trousers. Bleh. I put them on because that's all I had. I had a sudden insight into why people dressed up when they changed into civvies. After months of ship suits, as nice and practical as they were for what we did on a daily basis, putting on civvies ought to be something special. If I got new clothes, I'd have to get rid of these or take the hit on my mass allotment, but I understood why so many people did exactly that. I saw the boy toy belt hanging in the back of the locker then, and with a sudden burst of daring, I stripped out my old perfectly adequate belt and buckled on the supple leather with its gold metal and black dragon. I looked at myself in the mirror, and if I were perfectly honest, it looked a tad out of place. It didn't go with the rest of the outfit at all. It did, however, go with me. So I kept it on, scooped up the cargo duffel that Pip and I had packed the night before, slammed my locker, and headed for the cargo lock. I got there just after 0700. There was a crowd gathered already. I walked up to see what they were looking at and burst out laughing. When we first got the grav pallet for Mr. Cotton, I could see why it had been slated for salvage. It was pretty torn up. It would only lift about half its rated capacity. For our purposes, that was fine, since its rated capacity was in kilotons. We only needed to carry a few dozen kilos and style points. The pallet was now painted a matte black, and the top, where it had been heavily scarred by dropped loads and untold cargo calamities, was now covered with a uniform layer of pristine gray skid grid, the same nubbly rubbery matting that they laid down on cargo entries and engineering spaces where good footing was important. Along the skirting on all 4 sides, someone had stenciled McKendrick Mercantile Cooperative in a gray paint that matched the skid grid. Judging from the gray smudges on Biddy Murphy's cheek, I knew who'd done that. The black told me where Pip had found wet paint the day before. There was already a stack of gear on the pallet, including a basket with the banner and table coverings. I added my duffel to the pile, and we all stood there looking at it for a moment before Roan, the morning booth manager, took the tow handle and slid the pallet out of the lock. I stood there watching them go for a moment. I didn't really know what I felt. This crazy group of people going off on a great adventure that was no more exotic than a yard sale. The gray hairs were having as much fun as the kids. It was made all the more surreal when I thought that what they do in real life, when they're not selling trinkets at flea markets, is sailing a deep space leviathan between the stars. That wasn't exciting because that was just their job. "You better hurry, Ishmael. They'll leave you behind." I turned to see the captain standing there beside me, looking at the parade streaming out of her ship and across the orbital's dock. "Aye, sir, by your leave," I said, saluting for what might have been the first time since signing the articles. The captain smiled at me, returned the salute, and said, "Carry on, Mr. Wang. Carry on." As I stepped out through the lock, I swear I heard Lois laughing. Thanks for listening to episode 17 of Quarter Share, a trader's tale from the golden age of the solar.